Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On October 19th, the Norris Group proudly presented I Survived Real Estate 2012. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and the outlook for real estate in the coming year. Over $77,000 was raised to benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners. Foreclosure Radar, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, the Investors Workshops, Invest Club for Women, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Fry Wilds, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. Learn more about the panel and how to attend at isurvivedrealestate.com.
Do you agree with the FHA buyer thing? I did make a note.
I saw your negative comment on that.
It wasn't a negative comment. Look, the average FHA loan has a FICO requirement today of 760.
That's Fannie Mae. I guarantee you. I know that number off of like the back of my hand. It really is.
Bet your dollar.
But it's oh.
There you go.
Okay. You thought. Okay. Now I'll grant you. But what I'll give you some numbers because.
All right. Let's assume it's 712. Okay. Was that your number?
No, but you owe me a dollar then.
Okay.
Okay.
Will you take a check? Anyway, but the point is, somebody who's gone through a foreclosure is not going to be up over a 700 FICO score in 2 to 3 years.
Well, that's what's interesting too.
I think we're worrying about something. I don't think first time buyers are driving this market. Investors are driving this market, and
the first time buyer doesn't get a chance to buy anything. But they're there.
Absolutely right. They're the ones submitting 24 offers and not ever getting to buy anything. So
I bet they have a pre-qual letter.
I don't think it matters.
I think they have a pre-qual letter.
Yeah. Here's what I mean. Just on the yield being more important than comps at this point. You know, you think about Riverside, where you had the potential to get an ROI of better than 10%. Well, if you think about, this isn't necessarily the rents in this area, but I'm going to use this math to keep it simple. You think $2,000 a month in rent, $4,000 a year in expenses, that's a $20,000 income stream. So think about this in terms of a fixed income investment, right? So at a 10% yield on a $20,000 income stream, that equals a $200,000 price. And that's kind of where we were, right? Mm-hmm. But now we've got the private equity firms coming in and buying at a 7 cap. They'll buy anything they can at a 7 cap, and they don't care what the comps are. Well, at a 7 cap, that same income stream is $285,000. And I think that explains a lot of what we've seen here in California. Now, their plan, not Rick's, he's not doing this, Carrington's not doing this, but some of these guys' plans is to take this thing, package it into a REIT, and they're going to take the REIT out and float it with a 5% return. Right. So you do that math real quick. That's essentially a $400,000 value on the real estate.
Now, I'm going to frame this one, by the way.
You may do that.
But don't get too excited, because that $400,000 value in that REIT that that folks are going to invest in to get a good yield because they're buying into real estate when it's cheap and getting a fixed income return, all these people that don't want to own rentals, right? This is the way they're going to pitch these REITs. It's a $400,000 house, but it doesn't create a comp.
Right.
And I think that's the most interesting thing happening in housing right now. And I'm curious to see, versus your chart, how much of that is investor-driven by yield in those places versus the other things. I think it all contributes, but I think that's a big part of it.
Was that a short answer? Anyway.
No.
It was a good answer.
One more question, and then we'll have everybody else come up if we could. The new foreclosure law in California, what did it change? And just fill us in on that.
You got a feel for the states. Banks are federally regulated, right? This game is played at a federal level. But states still control the foreclosure process. So they want to penalize banks, whether it's the state's attorney general or the legislature with these new laws, and they want to penalize these banks and they want to bring them to task for what they did. And the funny irony of the whole thing is really all they do is delay the whole process, which with banks now being servicers, benefits them. They get to continue to collect that servicing fee. Mm. And ultimately, they have kind of a super lien against the house, against the actual investor. So they get to collect all their fees. When that house is finally disposed of, whether it's today or 10 years from now, they get super priority. They get to collect everything. And, you know, some of these investors are now finding out that, you know, they thought maybe they lost 10 or 20% of their money, but, you know, you have losses of 80, 90, 100% that have all been eaten up, not just by the downturn, but by all the fees through the servicing process.
I need to jump in there.
Go ahead.
Smaller, the specialty servicers, the ones who handle the processing of delinquent loans, in many cases are not banks, so they have to borrow money.
Right.
And a lot of those servicers have taken a huge hit on the cost of borrowing money, even though they do have a super lean position. So while you're paying, while you're making those advance payments, what people don't realize, most people, is servicers are required to make the payments on behalf of the borrower who's not making the payments. And the more money you have to borrow in order to do that, the more likely it is you're not going to be able to recover all of your losses over a long period of time.
Which is why it's good to be a bank and have Uncle Federal Reserve making money free.
The other big issue with the California Homeowners Bill of Rights isn't so much the prescriptive requirements.
Exactly. When did I lose control of this? Go ahead.
that's why I gave you the dollar. It's a lot of those prescriptive requirements are required by HAMP already, and a lot of them were in the AG settlement. So if you're a HAMP shop, you're doing a lot of that stuff anyway.
Specifically that. I mean, the state said we're going to enact the Attorney General's settlement.
The big aha in that bill is that it gives the individual homeowner the opportunity to pursue litigation against the lender and the servicer. And there's a little clause in there that stipulates that the lender and servicer are on the hook for court costs no matter who prevails.
Wow.
So that, yeah, everybody got that one. I like that. That's good. So that really is the shadow of that particular piece of legislation. And if it's not corrected, I think it's going to make mortgages more expensive to get in California.
Okay.
And that is still the next wave of this is the legal phase, right? The winners will be the ultimate, the winners here will ultimately be lawyers. Who
so
make the rules.
Maybe I'd sit next to you so we can talk about releasing reserves, but
all right.
Okay. You guys were kind enough to fill out a questionnaire, and so some of what I'm about to do is ask questions that had something to do with what you were concerned about. By show of hands, how many people are concerned about the fiscal cliff issues of our country? Almost nobody. No, I can't see. The light's too bright. Okay. So I'm just going to open it up. This is a quote from Bernanke. If the fiscal cliff isn't addressed, I don't think our tools are strong enough to offset the effects of a major financial shock. So I guess the opening question, and I'll let anybody start, are we taking this seriously? We haven't heard from Eric and Wally. Why don't you start it? And,
sure.
And, yeah, the mic, kind of get it close.
Grab the mic.
Yeah.
So the Congressional Budget Office came up with a number for the Fed to go out and talk about. It's 4% of GDP. So if all these tax laws expire and blah, 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 then by the first quarter of 2013, we have a negative 4% of GDP effect. And given that we're running at about 2% of GDP, obviously that would send us into recession. So it's really a message for Congress, don't do that.
Okay.
The bond markets, near as I can tell, don't think it's going to happen because they haven't moved. I would only say that if it somehow Congress didn't manage to fumble the ball across into 2013, it would be some kind of disaster. But it would be kind of a third world event for us. So I don't think it's very high probability.
Any other comments? I mean, I thought we were actually going to take it seriously, and you're saying it's mathematically absolutely certain we can't.
Right, we can't.
We can't.
So we won't.
We're in so much debt we can't.
If we
can't stop building debt at this point, and it's because of the timing of it. We already are. That output gap is a problem.
Look, we have a bond market. The last time we fumbled it, the bond market was about $800 billion. That was in the mid 1970s, and it was a very small default. Very small mistake, and it sent yields up, I think, about 30 basis points across the entire yield curve, and they never came down again. So bond markets are very unforgiving about these kinds of mistakes. So if we were to make a mistake on that scale, remember, now we have a $37 trillion bond market, it would have, obviously, a much larger impact.
I was going to add two things to that. And one is that you remember maybe two summers ago, it seems really a long time ago, we had the debt ceiling debacle. Consumer confidence reacted really negatively to that, even more so than investors. And at least what one sort of hears from people who try to stay in touch with what's going on in legislators' minds, is that that lesson seems to have sunk in. So I think that's one reason that the bond market is not as anxious about this as one might think. But the second, more important point, I think, around this is that it really highlights what Bernanke's frustrations are, in the sense that, and the frustrations for a lot of economists, in the sense that we just have massive fiscal problems. We basically have... we've promised people all sorts of things that just don't add up. And eventually some of those promises aren't going to be kept. And you know, among adults here in the room, we all wish we could, in some reasonable way, manage that process and get to the point where we get on a much more sustainable fiscal path. But, it's going to continue to be a problem. We've got the fiscal cliff now. You'll have another debt ceiling coming up eventually again. There's a real need to come up with some sort of budget deal. There's a need to deal with the fact that we have an aging population. We got the baby boomers. I mean, all this stuff is well known, but we just need to deal with it.
I think we need to ask China for a principal balance reduction.
good idea. The Fed's message is, we need Congress, you guys need to work on this fiscal problem, but not now, because now we're in an output gap, so you guys got to keep pouring it on. And, of course, in Japan, they've been doing this now for going on 20 years. So when does the not now happen, right? So that's always been the challenge.
Isn't there an expectation that it's actually going to get taken seriously by others? Let's say you guys have kind of informed me of it's different than I thought it was. I actually thought, I really did. I thought we were going to solve this somehow, and I thought we were going to have, okay, let's generate more revenue this way, let's cut back here, and let's at least do some of what we're supposed to do. Now you're leading me to believe...
Have you been paying any attention at all to this election? Any?
Well, you know, what's amazing, though, is don't we actually... We better show up with... Have a leader at some point that has... Maybe the guts and the ability to say, guys, we are not going to keep all of our promises. It's more honorable to let us know now than later.
Okay, and absolutely. And that person is?
Well, I know. That person hasn't shown up yet, apparently.
That's the problem. So if you ask any of the candidates right now, there could be general agreement in principle that we need to cut something. We start going down the list.
Okay, well, and that's one of the reasons why this meeting's important, because something that's on the list would be real estate. I mean, real estate to me is the low-hanging fruit, in a way.
Like the mortgage deduction.
Mortgage deduction, especially when you get 3% interest. I mean, honestly, how many people are going to have a deductible interest when they have a $300,000 loan and it's a 3% mortgage? Not if you're a married couple, so you could deduct it. I don't even know if it'd be revenue generating.
That's a good point.
Yeah. But what about, I mean, I'm not trying to take all the goodies away, but if you had to offer some up, how did we ever get the $500,000 free sale every other year for our asset? I mean,
That was Clinton's gift.
That was an amazing thing. I remember calling up Robert Bruss when I heard that, and I went, I haven't got that right. Every other year? Okay. Is that something that, couldn't that be taken, and would it even be defendable? In other words, no, we really need that.
It cracks me up that, you know, when we went back and spoke to Fannie and HUD, you know, one of the things that they were talking about is, well, boy, how do we separate out? Because we were there asking for more loans for investors. And they said, well, how do we separate out investors from speculators? And because we don't want to give loans to speculators, but we're okay with real investors. And I'm thinking, you know, $500K every 2 years, on the one hand, you want everybody to be a speculator, right? Because that's what that law basically said. And then on the other hand, but yeah, we don't want anything to do with them.
Well, I mean, it also benefits who?
It has to be a coastal state, right, in a boom. So it doesn't, I mean, it couldn't possibly benefit 45 states, let's say. And very few of the five would be cashing in now every
10 years instead of every two.
Anyway, are we seriously, do you collectively, or you're telling me, we don't have to worry of any goodies getting taken away from real estate, and we're going to completely ignore the fiscal cliff, and we'll see you the next elect?
Those are two separate questions.
Okay.
No, they really are.
I'm not going to pay you a dollar for it.
Just looking at the body language up here at the table,
yeah?
I think we're all kind of the opinion that we will not fall off the fiscal cliff. Okay, some miracle will happen in January or February, and amazingly, we'll figure out a way to get around that. But that doesn't mean that some goodies aren't going to come out of the goodie bag. I think anybody in here who makes a measurable income is in trouble. I do think that the mortgage deduction is probably very vulnerable right now, at least at some level. But it's hard to speculate right now because the election is too close to call in most polls, and I really do believe you'll have two very different philosophies in terms of how higher income taxpayers are treated depending on who comes into office. So if the current administration comes into office, I think that tax deduction is dead. I think there are probably going to be higher taxes, which are going to limit investment opportunities. If the other guy gets in, I don't know exactly what the policies are, but I suspect it'll be a little bit more lenient toward the higher end. So you're asking a question to an answer. You're asking an answer for a question. The question is moving right now. So it's really hard to pin it down and say this is where it's going
to
go.
So one way to frame this is to think about what would be the underlying principle that would be used to decide what gets cut. So you're going right to what is the most politically vulnerable would be the first thing to get cut. And you're thinking the mortgage interest deduction is probably top of the list. It did come up in the debates, which is unusual, yep. So it does stand out. But the reality is that in a much broader perspective, that principle aside, the minute we started to allow, I mean, government debt is nothing more than tomorrow's taxes plus interest. And the minute we allowed politicians to bribe us with their own money in this way without putting any limits on it is where we started to get into this trouble. And the only way out of it is to reverse that process and not have the decisions made on the principle of who has the strongest lobbies and who has the weakest lobbies. It's got to be based on
and that's not going to happen this election.
Is it already in place that there's going to be a 3.8% tax increase for 250 and above for interest and dividends? I mean, isn't that already in place if Obamacare goes forward?
It's already in place.
It's already in place.
It starts January 1st.
That's right. I don't know why that's not mentioned because we're, you know, we're really saying that we got to tax the rich more or whatever. Well, if you're rich at 250, it's already in place for next year, 3.8% added. Why hasn't that been mentioned? It's like they forgot or they don't. It doesn't count.
Nobody recognizes it until it hits them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, the interest rate deduction is almost like the holy grail of real estate.
Correct.
Okay. So you think what you said, I think, is you think they could go down to, say, 500,000? Or something to say, vary the amount of the deduction.
I think you're going to wind up with a variable deduction. It's going to be capped at a certain level, and underneath that, you'll have some sort of tiered structure. That's, you know, me with my extensive background in politics, That's what I think is most likely to happen.
I think that's right.
If you think about it, though, right, you know, I don't think it has much impact on most, you know, residential neighborhoods.
That's true.
Where it's going to have an impact is on yacht sales and second homes and second home neighborhoods, right? Because that's actually where the second home or the mortgage interest deduction becomes pretty pretty useful. So as you start thinking about where might it have an impact, I don't think it's going to, if it went away, does it have any impact on me as an investor in Riverside? I don't think so.
But it does change the variable a little bit in terms of looking at that rent versus buy variable, because suddenly your one of your benefits of buying becomes a little weaker.
At 3% with a $50,000 income, when most people under a $50,000 income don't pay federal taxes
anyways. So for your first-time home buyer who's in the 53% or 47%, depending on whose number you look at, it's a non-factor.
Right.
But they don't buy yachts.
No. That's why I'm saying it's bad for yachts.
Okay.
Actually, if you look at the numbers on second homes, it's not going to raise that much revenue if it's eliminated on second homes.
Oh, this is purely posturing.
Absolutely, it is.
The revenue
being
raised will pay for about 14 seconds of the government cost.
Exactly.
I mean, it's
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's an estimate. It could be 15 seconds.
Okay. I won't hold you to that. Do you think, what about capital gains? That's kind of important to this group. Capital gains tax increase?
I don't see it under either administration changing.
Don't see it either. Okay. I'm really surprised. I thought we would probably see a lot of changes because we actually have to see them. And now I'm being told we really need to see them, but we're not going to do them. And so there. I mean, that scares me. We're going to push it down. How far? This road is really long, man. This can has been on this road for a while. But doesn't the solution? I'm being a citizen. Doesn't the solution start becoming a lot more painful for the next generation?
Yeah. Sure.
Well, when do we go? Let's don't do that. That kind of drives me crazy.
You're in a state. You're in the only state in the union that put back into office virtually every assembly person and senator in the last election. A state that has a $20 billion budget deficit. And you're asking us why we're not doing something about it?
Okay, let's talk about Chapter 19 bankruptcy.
And you guys can't print money.
Yeah.
Well, no, we really can't. All right, let's talk about Chapter 19 bankruptcy. Is that the number? I think it is. I've studied it, and I'm a little tired, as you can imagine. So, but
nine, right?
Nine, thanks. I added a one. I'm glad you didn't bet me. I'd have lost a dollar. Okay, is that a serious... Well, first of all, it's a serious problem to have a big deficit, that you really maybe keep on going down that road. But Chapter 9 bankruptcy, from what I've seen, doesn't solve the biggest problem.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, California Property Solvers, Coldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Elite Auctions, For Investors by Investors, In a Day Development, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Incorporated, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lievas Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Pilot Limo, Realty 411 Magazine, Real Wealth Network, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, John Reisinger Photography, Sunoco Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Weston South Coast Plaza, and Winning in Tough Times, LLC. See isurvivedrealestate.com for the video from the live events.